a country that actually cares about families, the building block of everything. What will it take to get a country like that? Leaders who want it. For now, those leaders will have to be Republicans. There's no option at this point. But first, Republican leaders will have to acknowledge that market capitalism is not a religion. Market capitalism is a tool, like a staple gun or a toaster. You'd have to be a fool to worship it. Our system was created by human beings for the benefit of human beings. We do not exist to serve markets, just the opposite. Any economic system that weakens and destroys families is not worth having. A system like that is the enemy of a healthy society. Internalizing all this will not be easy for Republican leaders. They'll have to unlearn decades of bumper sticker talking points and corporate propaganda. They'll likely lose donors in the process. They'll be criticized. Libertarians are certain to call any deviation from market fundamentalism a form of socialism. That's a lie.
It was the monologue heard round the political world. Tucker Carlson, once an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, fun fact, delivered a 15-minute sermon on his highly rated Fox News program last Wednesday. It began as a response to Mitt Romney's op-ed against President Donald Trump, and it ended up basically arguing for a new brand or a brand new conservatism, or at least some kind of Trumpified reorientation, one that blames market forces and investment bankers and self-interested politicians for carelessly, heedlessly destroying the American family. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Editor's Roundtable edition of The Reason Podcast. I am Matt Welch, joined by my fellow editors, Catherine Mangu-Ward, Peter Suderman, and Nick Gillespie. A happy Market Fundamentalist Monday to you all.
Good morning.
The dollar be praised.
Happy Monday.
Quick reminder before we start, please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and so forth, and rate and review us whenever possible, early and often. So Tucker gave us a lot to chew on, big and small, but I wanted to start kind of microscopic here. Catherine, since you are that type of libertarian, the one who defends plastic bags and payday lenders, Tucker ripped you usurists there, saying if you care about America, you ought to exploits. Deliver yourself to oppose exploitation of Americans. Teleprompter's hard, man. Why don't you oppose the exploitation of Americans, Catherine?
That is a good and on-point question. It is actually similar to the question that Tucker asked me when I appeared on his show, where I sat down, the camera started rolling, and I think the first thing he said was something like, so let's just be clear for our viewers, do you think Americans matter? Or something like that. It was like, oh, I see. We're going to do that, huh? And it was like a segment about, you know, DACA. So it was like, well, yes, but also other people do, which is like a crazy thing to say, apparently. Right. So this whole rant was basically just like him stabbing me in the eye. And and it's, you know, I think
with
it's...
a spork.
No, it was pretty sharp. It hurt. It was like a... I mean, I know the whole thing is like, you know, the rusty spoon or the spork or whatever is worse, but like it felt pretty like all the way into my brain. Like it was long and sharp, this monologue. Anyway, we published a piece at Reason.com by Tim Sandifer, which I think is like a great response to this whole Tucker shenanigans. To me, the key piece is when Tucker says that iPhones never made anyone happy. And, you know, he's using it as synecdoche for all of the stuff that market capitalism has brought into our lives. And it's just like, to me, on the face of it, that is clearly untrue. iPhones have made people incredibly happy. They have made people's lives richer and more interesting and more connected. And that is true of all kinds of elements of market capitalism, up to and including payday loans, which I think, you know, obviously everybody loves to hate them, but there's a lot of literature suggesting that the alternatives are worse, that it's not as if there aren't payday loans, people don't need payday loans. They just have worse alternatives. And that's true for many, many, many of the fruits of market capitalism. It's not that those things are perfect. It's that all the alternatives historically and all of the alternatives going forward, if those things are banned or made less likely to emerge, are worse. And it's just, it's a very simple proposition, which Tucker is rejecting and which more and more conservatives and increasingly more and more Republicans are rejecting in a way that makes me really nervous for the future of American politics.
We'll flip that a little bit, Nick. You know, sure, iPhones make us happy, but it seems like Tucker's building backwards. We don't seem to be happier right now. We seem to be in a sadder place right now, even at this stage of late capitalism, etc. Is he not right about that, Nick Gillespie, famous happiness expert?
Yeah, oh, and the happiest man on earth as well, remember, for 3 or 4 years running. I think there is a ghost that is haunting this conversation, and it's the ghost of Joseph Schumpeter, the Austrian-born economist who ended his career at Harvard and wrote Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy in the 40s during World War II. And he prophesied, like Marx, that capitalism would destroy itself, but not by immiserating poor people to a point where everything went to the capitalists, the 1%, and, you know, people shake off or gain class consciousness and start a proletariat revolution. What Schumpeter essentially said was that people will, under a market system, under a free enterprise system, will take kind of productivity and wealth and the constant innovation and material surplus that comes with a free enterprise system for granted, and become disaffected by it, become take it for granted, think that it can be bureaucratized and managed in really easy ways, and end up losing the will and the ability to work. And I actually think that Tucker is part of that. I think there is a Schumpeterian moment going on where people on the right and the left increasingly are saying that capitalism is broken. And this is something, you know, we've talked about it a lot over the past few months. Tim Cook of Apple says that capitalism is broken and that the tech center sector needs to be regulated. Everybody on the left says it's broken. If you look, more and more people, as Catherine were saying, on the right are saying it's not working because it's and inevitably these are mostly political people or rent-seeking businesses that are trying to figure out how to maintain their status quo. Republicans and conservatives more generally are losing market share. We saw that in the most recent election because they can't deliver votes. So they want to figure out how do they deliver votes and what's going on. If you look at the actual facts, you know, people continue to do better than their parents en masse. And we need to figure out a way to talk about the positive dimensions in American society that are, in, I think, fundamentally consonant with libertarianism. I think I sent around to the staff this morning a story about Minneapolis getting rid of zoning for single family housing. This is the small type of incremental improvement that's actually going to make the housing market in Minneapolis much better, much freer, much more interesting and diverse. We can multiply all sorts of laws and all sorts of political situations that are getting better, you know, something like criminal justice reform or marijuana legalization, you know, fall into this, or the deregulation that's been done by the EPA and the FDA over during Trump's time. But that overall narrative of decline and desperation, both on the right and the left, I think we need to confront that and combat it. And I think that Tucker has, you know, he is locking into a certain thing where the world he grew up in doesn't exist anymore. And he wants to blame capitalism.
Peter, a bigger picture following up on that, you slacked to the group that the Tucker monologue was very clearly influenced by the new Orrin Cass book, which you happen to review for the next issue of Reason. What is going on here?
So Orrin Cass is a scholar at the Manhattan Institute, a policy advisor for the Mitt Romney campaign in 2012, and really a pretty sharp guy in a lot of ways. Kind of a top flight, you know, think tank policy expert, campaign advisor, type of person. And he is his book has gotten a lot of attention. It's been written about by Ross Douthat and David Brooks in the New York Times and a number of other folks. And it kind of draws on a lot of the reformocon policy ideology that goes back at least a decade or so. And you can maybe trace it back to Ross Douthat and Raihan Salam's book and previously article in the Weekly Standard, Grand New Party, which sort of argued for a working class focus for the Republican Party.
Sam's Club.
Basically making it a little bit more populist. And doing some technocratic kind of tweaking of policy, things like wage subsidies. That was a big thing in Ross and Raihan's book. Orrin Cass recommends it as well. Cass basically is trying, I think, to advocate for a more consistent cogent, coherent form of Trumpism. It's sort of what Trump, it's a Trumpist economic policy, if Trump were capable of having one that made any kind of sense. And a big part of it, and I think this is, you really see this in Tucker's monologue too, and this is the thing that's that stood out to me most in the book and in the monologue, is that there's all these policy ideas, some of which are actually pretty good, I should say, and some of which we would think are at least better than the policy ideas we have now, including a lot of sort of deregulation of the EPA, changing the way that we do that we fund sort of anti-poverty programs, which Cass does a really nice job of drawing out the ways that they basically, in their current form, pay people to be poor. But there's really a core here of an argument that the job of government is to give people meaning and make them happy. And Tucker basically says this directly. The goal for America is both simpler and more elusive than mere prosperity. It's happiness. It's happiness. And this, I think, is the real kind of error and the real flaw in this. Right. Yeah. Good luck with that, for one thing. No, but it's like, I mean, Cass says, well, you know, currently policy is entirely aimed at growing GDP. On the right, it's just so that we can sort of have a bigger economy. And on the left, it's so that we can have an economy that pays for redistribution and welfare. His argument is that instead we should be sort of creating an economy that's geared towards positive labor market outcomes, especially for low-skilled people, basically making them able to raise a family, and in particular for to try and keep and restore industrial sort of 50s-style factory jobs. But really, it's about organizing domestic economic policy around a vision of what the good life is, that Orrin Cass and Tucker Carlson and a bunch of these folks think they know what it is, and they think that the government can make it happen for everyone. And it is a crazy idea. And it is really, I think, disturbing that they have transformed, you know, sort of the Declaration of Independence, not that one, the original one, the idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, to life, liberty, and the guarantee of happiness.
The achievements of happiness.
And I think it's just a huge mistake. It's a huge error in the way that they are thinking about what policy can do, what it should do, and what the role of government is. It does, I think, get at something that's real, which is that there are a lot of people kind of who feel a little aimless in the modern economy. And the Republican Party in particular lacks a clear sense of what it should do in terms of economic policy and is kind of grasping for a new idea. And they are attempting to supply one. But this idea that government should supply meaning to people is I think, a very bad and very dangerous idea that we should oppose pretty vigorously.
I was struck in the clip that we played from Tucker, him just sort of saying, well, you know, we need leaders to help deliver this. And obviously right now that can't be Democrats. And you wonder, I mean, he's talking about market fundamentalism. That is a classic, like, George Soros word from beginning in the late 90s, you know, sort of talking about the market fundamentalists are going around the world and with all their investment banking and, you know, free flows of capital. So it was a self-hatred situation as far as Soros was concerned. But that's all they care about. And because of that, they're doing wrong. Why? I saw a vision from Tucker that is not that distinguishable here from Elizabeth Warren type of Democratic Party thing. Could this be part of a realignment, or is there enough of a sense of, you know, I want a country you might recognize when you get old, feeling that it gets more into kind of ethno-populism here?
So I think the thing that anchors Tucker's vision in conservatism is that his fundamental unit is the family, right? Like, he keeps coming back to that as the fundamental unit. And, you know, to be, it's sort of a fair cop to say, like, us libertarians, us market fundamentalists, like, that's not our fundamental unit, usually. You know, there are some exceptions to people who I think make a very compelling case for how markets support families or help families achieve their own ends best. But mostly individualists is what you're going to get over here on the libertarian side. And I think it makes a very big difference because your Elizabeth Warrens are certainly not going to cop to the fundamental unit being the family. Maybe don't think it is. Almost certainly don't think it is. It's unclear. They might think the fundamental unit is the community. That's a possibility. Might be the individual. Probably not. The other option for conservatives is the nation, right? And Tucker is blending the family and the nation here, which is a classic authoritarian move. So I think, you know, I think that's the thing that keeps Tucker's monologue outside of just, you know, what you would otherwise hear out of the mouth of a more left-wing populist. But the actual policy prescriptions aren't that different. I mean, there's sort of a question of how you would tweak the algorithms, you know, what exactly are you promoting? And I think in those cases, he would favor stuff that makes traditional families more likely to survive and be the predominant force in society. But other than that, I mean, you're quite
right. What does that possibly mean, though?
You mean in terms of policy?
Yeah.
It means child tax credits. It means,
that,
you know.
Yeah, but all of that stuff eliminating. I know you're not supporting it, but it's, you know, the reason why marriage rates have gone down, and it's the same reason why the number of children per
is because all these women are working down for the corporations instead of their families, according to Tucker.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's true, though. It's that they're, you know, that women have more options, including, you know, not to get married or not to have three children and instead have one or two. And this is where I think both the right and the left get, you know, lost in terms of they are trying to, as Peter was kind of suggesting, they're trying to lay over a template from the past onto the future and make it stay this way. And the fundamental question isn't whether or not what's going on is good or bad, really. It is like, what can government do and what can society do in a larger sense to kind of cope with different living arrangements? Like, what does it mean when women have effective freedom or effective equality with men? It changes the way society is, and it's not going to go back to Tucker's vision of the family. It's also not going to move towards whatever you know, Bernie Sanders wants either. And this is a place where I think libertarians can actually come up with or add to the policy discussion. We don't, you know, I think it's well put. Government is there to provide for the pursuit of happiness, to allow a path for people to find, you know, what, you know, to follow their bliss, to identify it and then be able to follow it. What are the types of policies that we can be talking about that would actually, without vitiating the power of the free market, would also maintain a certain amount of social stability so we stop having these conversations about how everybody's got to be in a two-parent, single-income household or everybody has to get everything from the government because otherwise somebody might not get anything.
Well, it's actually surprising how belatedly conservatives are coming around to very extensive government-provided or mandated maternal leave. I mean, it's actually, it is a sign that Tucker is onto something here when he says, for a long time, Republicans have sort of, even if they no longer maybe felt it deeply in their hearts, have sort of mouthed this gospel of growth and of unfettered markets. Because once you drop that, which is what Tucker is urging people to do, of course you want to pay women to stay home and raise children. Of course you want to do that. And, you know, we're already seeing softness from the Trump White House on that question. Mm-hmm. I think it's very, very likely that the
Ivanka's signature.
Yeah, I think it's very, very likely that the next Republican primary will feature lots of Republicans advocating mandatory leave or some variant thereof.
I mean, there's a new policy proposal that's going around where it's basically paid for by allowing people to take money out of their future Social Security.
Right.
It is almost perfect. Which in theory doesn't create a budgetary
cost for it. It allows you to basically give yourself an advance on Social Security.
But there previously wasn't any desire to finagle the math in that way, and now there is.
I wouldn't say there previously hadn't been. You can go back 10, 15 years and see kind of populist right, again, the reformicon, reform conservative types have been talking about both child tax credits and ways to they basically argue that there is a penalty for having children and that that government should offset that penalty, that we have mispriced children and that government policy should be designed to correctly price it.
What you mean we, Kimo Sabi?
Yeah.
Peter,
I mean, you and me in this sound booth right now should come up with a correct pricing scheme for children.
Yeah, how about zero, or that it, when you have a kid, you pay more in taxes because you've suddenly jacked up the amount of public money that your family is going to be consuming?
Whoa.
No, I say that as a father of two. It is worth going back to looking at the failure of the Reformicon movement, which is only a few years old, because it was predicated upon growing the size, scope, and spending of government in social welfare programs as if we were not already doing a ton of stuff, or as if all of the things that they had been talking about had been tried and it had already failed in terms of goosing fertility rates and paying people to have kids and all of that kind of stuff, where it's going to work out the way that they want, and we're going to go back to a two-parent household, two-parent, one-income household with 2.5 kids, et cetera.
As someone who occasionally has Reformicon sympathies and is friendly with a lot of those folks, I will say that there is like a core insight that they have that I think is largely right, that libertarians can agree with, which is that the kind of Reaganite, post-Reagan policy synthesis on the right, especially with regards to domestic policy, just isn't working and isn't correct for this moment.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea that you can solve all of today's problems by doing whatever Ronald Reagan did. Ronald Reagan, who, yes, cut tax rates and, yes, did many good things as a president, also grew the size of government and grew the deficit, led to the first efforts at sequestration, however the hell you're supposed to say that, a whole bunch of stuff like that. I mean, there is a sort of, they start from a good idea, a correct idea, which is that the Republican Party is perpetually stuck in the early 1980s and in a kind of Reagan veneration that now has diminished into basically having no policy agenda at all, except or domestic economic policy agenda at all, except for more tax cuts for everything, without commensurate spending cuts, without a kind of meaningful reform of how government goes about its business. And I think it's not good to have one party be so thoroughly empty when it comes to an agenda.
I agree that you're right, that there, you know, it stems from a recognition that current policy is not working. Unfortunately, I think it immediately goes off the rails there.
Yeah.
And I'm always happy to have, you know, and I think as libertarians, we should be happy, because we're being tarred in all sorts of ways as, you know, white nationalists, or as market fundamentalists, or as rigid dogmatic thinkers. It's like, for fuck's sake, libertarians, certainly for as long as reason has been around, have been saying, look, here are the unintended consequences of all of these different government policies, and here are ways to do that better. And I think, you know, when it comes to kind of social welfare spending, the first thing is to actually treat people as individuals in two distinct ways that are worth underscoring. The first is that, you know, as an individual, your income varies. And if simply because you're old, simply because you've passed 65 for Medicare and 67 and a half for Social Security, you shouldn't necessarily be getting all of this stuff handed to you just because. You know, treat individuals as individuals and help poor people. If you want to like minimize or abolish poverty, do that. The second thing is to recognize that at all levels, to the extent that we have government transfers, the individual receiving them should be given as much autonomy as possible, I think, to spend that in a way that they think will improve their lives. I mean, we've spent so much time, and part of this is under George W. Bush, because he came into office during recession, he massively expanded all kinds of disability payments, which is something that every president and every Congress does whenever there's a recession. We never really reeled that back in. And that's messed up. Like, you shouldn't have to pretend to be disabled if you need money, and then you stay out of the workforce. Because, Peter, I think you mentioned that in a lot of cases, getting off of welfare, there is a massive tax penalty that you pay the minute you actually start to work again. So I think those two things are the starting point of a meaningful conversation. And I think libertarians have been having that conversation for a long time. And it's important, particularly at this moment, as the right and the left are converging on this idea of government as guarantor of happiness. We really need to push back and say, hey, you know, look, here is a better way to move forward.
Yeah, just the one thing that you mentioned there that I want to sort of bring up is that there is a really an idea built into a lot of this. You see it in Tucker's monologue. You see it in Orrin Cass's book. You see it just sort of all over this strain of populist right thinking, that the real problem is libertarians, and that the government, that the government is just way too libertarian and has been for 40 or 50 years. And like, I don't know, but like talk to anybody who considers themselves a libertarian. And yes, we've had a few victories in terms of things like pot legalization and gay marriage, and even criminal justice reform. But in the realm of like spending, in terms of size of government issues, in terms of how programs are run and what programs exist, like we have done nothing but lose for 40 years. And I just think it's absolutely nuts to say that libertarians are the real problem, and libertarian ideology, libertarian thinking, libertarian policymaking, that's not what the problem is. And really, if you're saying that the problems of the American underclass, the American, you know, the less educated workers have grown up in response to the government policies of the last 40 years, then it's the expansion of government that has coincided with the development of all of these issues.
Catherine, building on Peter's last point there, I recall about a decade ago, maybe a little bit less, Tucker Carlson gave a pretty notorious speech at the Conservative Political Action Conference, notorious in the room, not in its content, at least from my point of view, saying that Republicans and conservatives need to create their own New York Times, by which he meant a very highly professional fact-gathering institution rather than just kind of propaganda, pugilistic, partisan kind of thing. This is before he had launched the Daily Caller, which I think we could say without fear of retribution, has not delivered on the promise that Tucker Carlson was laying out there. But I found myself watching his monologue and thinking about various things, the way that his depictions, not just of libertarianism, but of some policy questions, didn't fit any reality that I recognize. Not just that, you know, Brooklyn and West LA don't really run the world on one hand, but that like libertarians are primarily motivated because they get rich by international trade. It's kind of the actual inverse. I mean, my interest in international trade is precisely due to living in countries that were much poorer and were trying to get build themselves back up. And trade was the mechanism to do it. And it was idiot protectionists like at that time, George H.W. Bush, not that he was fully an idiot protectionist, but he engaged in protectionist policies that made it more difficult for those people to get back up. However, the place that it got the most fact untethered Tucker's monologue to me was having to do with pot legalization. Like, pot legalization is because the elites figured out how to make money out of that. Talk a little bit about the spork in your eye when Tucker's talking drugs.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this is it is almost always wrong to try and explain people's politics or their ideology purely on material logic, right? Like, this is it just isn't actually true that people vote in the way that makes them personally richer, by and large. Now, you know, sometimes like the human mind is a confusing and terrifying place, and personal interest and principle get tangled up in ways that is hard for even the holder of the view to see and understand. At the same time, yeah, the libertarians I know are not libertarians because they figured out how to make money off a pot. And what's more, it's never been mysterious how you could make money off a pot. I mean, Pfizer understood how they could convert marijuana into money a bazillion years ago. That was not the dawning revelation that triggered legalization.
I feel like there's a lot of like guys on scooters wearing beanies who have figured that out.
Yes.
Right?
Like, also,
it's not like some genius move.
Like literally, how could we make money on weed is a thing that the dumbest person you knew in college figured out how to do. So, I guess, you know, again, I think there is, it is a bad and lazy habit to attribute to your political opponents only interest in their personal material well-being. That is almost never what's going on.
Yeah, he broke your resolution for everyone else.
He did break my resolution for everyone else. Don't attribute bad faith. And I think this, again, this story that he's telling, which, and Peter mentions this in his review of Orrin Cass's book, I really think it can't be overstated. Like 100% of this political conversation seems to be driven by that one Case Deaton study that says that, like, poor white dudes are dying at a slightly higher rate than they were in the last decade or so.
I think 100% is an exaggeration, but
it's like 96%.
But it is part of the Carlson monologue, right?
It's in the monologue. It shows up everywhere. Yeah. And I think it's such an interesting example of a study crystallizing and offering a kind of sense of scientific validity to a general vibe that people had been having. And frankly, it's often the case, like Case and Deaton are really smart and are, and like their study is probably solid as hell. At the same time, like so often it turns out when you try to dig deeper on those type of studies, these studies that like pivot the whole political conversation, they're not as rock solid as they turned out to be. I am looking forward to what I am sure is already underway, which is the undermining of that study. Now, it won't matter because everyone will already believe it's true. It's too late for that study to be undermined.
So there's already an argument going on about this study. And the basic argument is their study found that there was an uptick in what they describe as
deaths of despair,
which are white middle-aged people in areas with poor economic performance are dying more often from suicide and drug overdose. And there's some research.
So much so that the overall death rate is higher.
And so they are arguing that this is caused by the declining economic opportunity for less educated people in rural areas that are struggling economically. There's a countervailing study that came out that basically says, no, it's not about economic circumstances. In fact, it's about the drug environment, basically what sort of drugs are available and how cheap they are. And that since about 2010 or so, that a huge amount of the deaths can be attributed to restrictions placed on prescription opioids in an attempt to keep people from abusing them. And so because of that, the drug environment has shifted and people are now taking more dangerous synthetics and substitutes like fentanyl.
So in conclusion, legalize all the drugs.
Yes. Every time, more than ever. Nick, part of what Tucker was saying, which is kind of interesting or implying heavily, was that Mitt Romney doesn't pay enough in taxes and that too much of conservative and Republican orthodoxy has all been about protecting the rich people from paying taxes. There's another politician who's almost as famous as Donald Trump, who's been talking about the same thing over the past week. And on 60 Minutes, that's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She has created single-handedly a conversation about 70% marginal tax rates among people who earn $10 million or more. You wrote about this over the weekend. What do you make of this new, let's get back to Eisenhower brackets discussion?
It again is a sign that we are out of ideas. When you look at how much of both on the right and the left, how much backward looking there is, the entire election between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, it was about two people kind of stuck in the 1970s, kind of dueling it out for who would run, you know, America in the second decade of the 21st century. I mean, that's what they were. You know, Hillary on a kind of economic side and Donald Trump with his fixation on crime and various other kind of social pathologies and things like that. You know, for what it's worth, by the way, in 2016, the top 1% of income earners paid 44% of all income taxes. So when you start talking about people paying their fair share, you know, and you can say, well, they should pay the same share as the national income that they have or whatever. But I think when you start talking about going back to, you know, the past, it is an obvious indicator that we do not, or and certainly liberals and conservatives or progressives and right-wingers, however you want to kind of slice it up, do not have a vision for a future in which America keeps getting richer. And again, I go back to Russ Roberts and other people have talked about this. Pew Research has documented that individuals are, generally speaking, at any stage of the game, are better off than their parents were. That still holds true. That is not the story that we're telling ourselves. We're telling ourselves that we are in a country where costs of standards of living are constantly declining, that people are dying because they are so depressed by the what is offered them in their lives. They're dying in huge numbers. These deaths of despair. The world is melting down.
It's a tongue twister.
It is.
Deadly tongue twister.
A tongue twister. Yeah, now you can choke on it, literally. That the world is burning, that China, forget Japan now, but China and maybe Russia are eating our lunch. We need a forward-looking narrative that is not simply, let's go back and make everybody be like they were, 20 years ago, which is what the right and the left is offering us. And I think this is... It's a real problem with libertarianism in the sense of that libertarian ideas, I think, basically inform what helps living standards to increase, which includes technological innovation. It includes, not just cultural pluralism, but a kind of economic dynamism that can be very disruptive. A commitment to what Tyler Cowen calls, long-term sustainable economic growth. That, and it doesn't make you a market fundamentalist, and it doesn't mean that all regulation is equally bad and should never be broached or anything like that. But we also don't tend to have large prescriptions where we say, here is the good life. Now let's use the government to go and implement it. I think it's a real failing of current or maybe it's endemic to kind of libertarian thinking.
I mean, it's just worth highlighting on that point that Tucker Carlson and Orrin Cass are both very explicit in saying that the foremost goal of government policy, we should give up on the idea that it should be to grow GDP, that it should be economic growth. They want to not have Cass doesn't say, well, economic growth shouldn't be a factor at all, but he says it's been the primary driver of policy for both basically for the center left and the center right for decades, and we should stop thinking about government's primary job in the realm of domestic economic policy to grow the economic pie.
He says instead we should try to maximize happiness. Tucker says happiness.
Tucker is more explicit about happiness.
Cass is doing something a little more sophisticated.
Yes, it's much more sophisticated.
But
I think it's
interesting that especially from Tucker, that like all discussion of rights has disappeared entirely inside this happiness category. He says all of both government and markets are tools, and that we built them and we can dismantle them. And, normally this is the place, right there is the place where conservatives say, and our rights, which come from God and are sacrosanct, are the thing that makes America great because we have all these rights here. And that's gone now. And while I am not a natural rights theorist, while I actually think that talk is generally mumbo jumbo, it is very interesting to me that it is absent.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is the best simple description of what government should attempt to do. It should attempt to secure your person. Healthier, safer lives, right? Through things like the common defense, is a good thing for government to try to do. Liberty, the idea that you can make your own destiny and make your own choices, that is a good thing for government to try to secure for people. And the pursuit of happiness, right? That the country can be a platform for finding whatever it is you want to find in the world, with the idea that the people who are making the laws and who are helping to secure those first two things, life and liberty, don't know what happiness is. They think that you would know better than them. And this is the inverse of this, of that. It's the exact opposite. And I think it's dangerous and very worrisome that this is where the right is heading under Donald Trump. And, I have had quite a few discussions about, Peter, why do you dislike Donald Trump so much? And a big part of my distaste for Donald Trump is that it has been very clear to me for the last 3 years that if the more that Trump takes over the Republican Party, the more a huge segment of our politics. Basically, the Republican Party, the conservatism as we know it, ends up moving in this direction and ditching life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as the ideal for what government should do in favor of happiness provision.
Nick, speaking of that and shifting a bit to Trump's actual policies or utterances that have to do with policy, we're still in the government shutdown right now. You know, praise be Allah. And part of what the president's floated, I think it was a press conference on Friday, was that he might declare a national emergency to build the border wall on his own, including using what he termed as a military style eminent domain. From your point of view, can you tease out the tension between Trump's vision of fulfilling Peter Suderman's idea of providing for the common defense and the more traditional Republican concern of securing people's rights, how these things seem to be in conflict with the way that Trump described what he might do with the wall?
Well, Matt, and I know you are old enough to remember as well, when every time Republicans would go batshit crazy when Bill Clinton would send, National Guardsmen or troops or whatever to help watch over the Mexican border back when he was super anti-illegal immigrant in the 1990s. And now you have, the Republican president basically, threatening to declare a national emergency. He's already in previous tweets, he talked about one of the reasons to bring the troops home from Syria and Afghanistan is so that they could literally build the wall on the Mexican border. It's hard to be troubled by what Trump says, because he says so much and so much of it is clearly, just kind of like gas bubbles, swamp gas rising up and popping above the surface. But I actually think if he tries to invoke a national emergency in order to, jumpstart building the wall, we've gone into a full, potential beyond constitutional crisis, particularly because, and there was a great segment that Chris Wallace on Fox News did where he interviewed this Sunday, he interviewed Sarah Sanders, who was claiming that there were 4,000 terrorists, stopped at the border coming in through Mexico. And then Wallace had to walk her through that number. And what that meant is that there were 4,000 people who were from countries in which, extra vetting is designated for people coming through the border. So there is an enormous amount of lying about, who is crossing the southern border, what types of people they are. And then to use that kind of misimpression or that misinformation to actually say, oh, yeah, I'm just going to do this is troubling. I mean, this is like, I think it puts Trump in the category of, and obviously this jumping ahead a little bit, of Andrew Jackson being told by the Supreme Court that no, actually the Cherokee have a treaty and they get to stay, and then he just does what he does anyway. I mean, it would set the ground for that type of stuff, and it would be appalling to see that Congress can actually override presidential declarations of emergency. That was something that was put in after Nixon. If it happens, we'll know who the real kind of Americans and the small R Republicans are.
Note that Trump's trade war, the tariffs, have been largely justified on completely horseshit national security grounds.
Which gives him the ability to.
A couple of Republicans have kind of said that's ridiculous. Nobody in Congress, no Republicans in Congress, have made any effort to actually do anything.
That's not true. Sorry. Republicans. I believe it was Bob Corker. At least Bob Corker gave a speech about it. But there was a bill, a resolution, I think, even put forward by, Mike Lee or some damn Mormon out there, saying that actually let's give the Senate an up or down vote on when the president invokes national security on a tariff, because that seems kind of crazy. And let's do it. And famously, this is what triggered Bob Corker's poke the bear speech, where he pointed out that this resolution will never get voted on. This amendment for this thing will never get voted on because we don't vote on amendments anymore in the United States Senate. Why? Because Mitch McConnell is afraid to poke the bear. Don't want to get anything in front of Donald Trump's nose. This actually comes up in the government shutdown
I retract
context.
My nobody has attempted anything, but they did that knowing that Mitch McConnell was not going to
That he was,
actually,
what is it about Mitch McConnell that we know? He's afraid to what?
Poke the bear.
Thank you.
Virtually all tariffs, all kind of tariffs and reprisal of things have in the past 20 or 30 years have been invoked under the national security claim, which, as Peter points out, is horseshit. And this, without going back to every other episode of every podcast we've done, I mean, in the end, this is what happens when Congress stops doing its job and you have an imperial presidency. You know, that already starts off where you're wearing all of the robes that Napoleon and a bunch of other old emperors wore, and then you have Congress completely go out to lunch.
Bingo.
I mean, it's amazing to me, and I don't want to sound like a common MSNBC guest here, although I'm a common MSNBC guest.
You are a common MSNBC guest.
But Nancy Pelosi, upon taking the gavel, immediately passed the exact same piece of continuing resolution that the Senate unanimously passed. And it's not even kind of being put forth as a possibility much that the Senate might re-vote on the same thing that already unanimously passed and put it on the president's desk. And I say that as no lover of any continuing resolution or government in general. But it's just assumed that, of course, Mitch McConnell wouldn't put this on the president's desk because the president wouldn't like it, even though you, by definition, have the votes to override his veto. That's amazing to me. And it'll be interesting to see as this thing goes, the shutdown continues, and it'll get less popular over time.
Can I ask a procedural question, Senior Welch? Why is, if they voted on the same bill, like, why isn't that automatically going to the president's desk?
That was in the last Congress. This is in the new Congress.
Okay. Thank you.
So the bills have to theoretically originate in the House. The House version of a bill that got passed and sent to match up with the Senate bill was a different one than the Senate bill. So there was no reconciliation and et cetera. But it's just astonishing to watch all of that. But Catherine, just to play complete devil's advocate here, or at least an advocate of some sort, like, we went through back in the Ronald Reagan's day, there's what, 28 was the average number of national or federal emergencies declared. That has surprisingly gone up every subsequent administration, and Donald Trump is averaging, I think, 130 national emergencies. So it seems like We've got a process for doing this. And not only that, according to the Crackerjack Joe Setian post, and I'm going to mispronounce his name every time on purpose, talking about the military version of eminent domain. There is a military version of eminent domain in terms of fortifications to provide for the common defense in a Peter Suderman-like way. Kind of sounds like he's got the legal authority to do this, no?
No. So basically, there's, of course, there are national security exceptions to everything because that's how we've built our system. At the same time, if you watch the exchange in the Rose Garden press conference, what he actually says is he's answering a question about whether eminent domain lawsuits fighting eminent domain claims will delay the building of the wall intolerably. And he says, well, first of all, we've already bought a lot of the land, or we've already acquired it through various means. So that's been he basically is doing the thing that real estate developers do when you're like, hey, this, you know, there's a sign outside this project that says it's going to be completed in spring 2019, and it's spring 2019, and there's like a hole in the ground. What's up? And he's like, well, we've been doing a lot of the infrastructure work, you know. But then he says also, well, I've looked into it and I can use the military version of eminent domain to start building while the lawsuits are pending, essentially. And, you know, it's Donald Trump. So there's like four or five different starts and stops in that sentence. And all of the like pronouns refer to unclear things. So it's a little unclear even what he thinks his powers are in this case, but he seems to be talking about, obviously, not like the building of, you know, the kind of laws that allow the instant building of fortifications, and instead sort of a procedural loophole that will let him start building while the lawsuits are pending. And of course, he's right to believe that if the wall is there and then the lawsuit moves forward, it's going to be much harder to get it torn back down. All of that is still contingent, though, on the declaration of a state of emergency, which there are checks on that. One thing that actually years ago we did a feature in Reason, when presidents declare states of emergency, they have to be undeclared at the end of the emergency. They have to be removed. Oh. And there are like still states of emergency technically pending from decades ago. There's actually like we are very sloppy about wrapping up our states of emergency. And you got to believe that's on purpose, you know, in the same way that the continuing resolution for Iraq and Afghanistan has like justified every foreign policy adventurism idea ever since. It is convenient for presidents to have state of emergencies ongoing, states of emergency ongoing. And this may be no exception. I have hope. I don't know. Am I wrong to have hope that if the president actually straight up tried to declare a state of emergency to build the border wall, that people might stop him? Is that crazy?
I think the only thing that would stop him is court action, because as Nick pointed out, Congress doesn't do anything anymore.
Although they do have the right to.
They have the right to. I think it would depend on how it was sold, obviously. But also, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg missed her first day of hearings since like 1992 today. So she's about to kick it. And that's going to shake things up again.
Wow. Let's pivot from your death prediction here.
I'm just happy that we managed to get Damon Root's excellent feature about the cult of Ruth Bader Ginsburg out before she died, because it would have been extremely churlish to post this negative piece after she died. So congratulations to us.
Wow. You know, it's a good thing that you are not a market fundamentalist or a heartless libertarian of any sort, Kat.
I don't sound like it, do I? Yeah. It's fine.
Reason magazine editor literally wants people to die.
In a timely fashion. Actually, she wants her to hold off dying, right?
So. I do.
But we published it already, so.
Yeah.
She
now
says, live a little longer. You know, Reason editor to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, live a little longer.
I should point out that I got rid of a whole bunch of books for my house recently, and one of them was by or co-written by and about Herb Kelleher, the late founder of Southwest Airlines. And so like 3 days after, you know, I left a Herb Kelleher book out on my stoop, he dies.
You killed him. That's on you.
I killed him.
Don't whatever you do, don't put the Declaration of Independence out.
I
want to live, damn it. I want to live.
Suicide by curbside book drop is a real, that's a real power
move. What
kind
of magic are you making out there?
True fact, Nick. As part of that, because I wrote a little thing about Kelleher on the site, I'm like, oh, so where's the book? I need to look at our chapter there. I couldn't find it. Can't find a copy of the book in my own house.
No, I got a couple. I'm happy to sell you them at cost, Matt. Plus shipping, of course.
If this keeps going this direction, I may die a death of despair before the end of the podcast.
Peter, take us out of this by talking about what cultural product, besides the Declaration of Independence paperback version, you have consumed since the last time that we spoke.
That was a new foreword or a new afterword. I can't remember.
New hope.
Yeah. Now, I think it had, incalculably less hope, but...
I mean, I've been thinking about a new hope a lot because I think about Star Wars all the time.
Yeah.
But I've been watching the second season of Counterpart on Stars. It is a science fiction spy thriller starring J.K. Simmons in a dual role. It basically posits that about 30 years ago in Berlin, they discovered a portal to a world that was exactly the same as ours, except that as soon as the portal was discovered, it started to diverge in small ways. And then the other side of the world now believes, perhaps accurately, but the parallel world that is not ours now believes that a plague was a biological attack engineered by our side, and so there's been a sort of a Cold War-esque standoff between the two sides. They have much more advanced biological technology. We have much more advanced kind of digital technology, and it's really a kind of fascinating spy show that sort of has echoes of the Cold War, as I said, but also allows all of the actors and the performances are just uniformly excellent, but all the actors to play two versions of themselves and to kind of show off how just how subtle they can be as performers. It's really it's a smart, gripping show. I reviewed the first season, I believe, for the print edition last year, and I would definitely recommend anybody who likes science fiction, spy thrillers, J.K. Simmons, good acting. I don't know. Things that are
good. That's everyone. You just
expanded expanded cable.
The set of people that you just named is all people.
So I would recommend that everyone watch the show. It's really good.
The J.K. Simmons Peter, piece you, is what
Peter,
cleaned
do you,
up.
Do you watch, do you still watch cable TV mostly? In terms of like when you, I mean, you have a cable package and you're watching on like a big screen.
I do have a cable package and I watch on a big screen. I almost never watch when the show airs, though. Occasionally with some of the HBO shows. So I'll probably, True Detective season 2 is starting this month, and I will probably watch at least the last couple of episodes.
Season 3, but yeah.
Season 3.
Are you guys like that? Yeah. Do you, you know, and it varies so much, but I know so many people who have either dropped cable or watch everything on computer screens or tablets as opposed to large TVs. I have a big TV and a Roku, and I still have a cable package, so I watch Netflix and Amazon mostly on large screens. I'm curious if Catherine and Matt, if you've made that switch.
Big screen, no cable.
Big screen, cable.
Yeah. And Catherine, do you have Hulu as well? Or
I have Netflix and Amazon Video. I do not have Hulu.
Yeah, I can't stand anything. I try to not look at things on my phone or on my computer if I ever have the opportunity to, due to oldness. Nick, speaking of oldness, what have you been consuming?
Oh, I've been consuming an old book, actually. I guess what passes for an old book, Raymond Chandler's The Long Goodbye, one of his Philip Marlowe novels, which is... it's just fantastic. I mean, the Philip Marlowe character is a great kind of, you know, this is a hard-boiled detective, L.A. noir at its finest. And it is, it's all about, you know, kind of the intersections of folly and human frailty and power. I had read The Long Goodbye a long time ago. I saw one movie version of it, and it's a weird thing in winter in New York to be reading about, an LA detective in the 40s. It's a kind of nice mind trip.
Fun fact about that. Let's see if I can distill it in 90 seconds or less. Long Goodbye, like a lot of American pulp fiction, was translated into French and published after the war in a series that they called Série Noire back then. All the books in Série Noire had basically the same cover, regardless of whether it was Raymond Chandler or James Cain or people who had
Dashiell Hammett,
yeah. But also people who had Goodis, forget his name, James Goodis, maybe, had nothing to do with one another. But they're very popular, very well done. A good friend of ours from L.A., great French journalist and also a translator named Philippe Garnier, sort of the Grover Lewis of French rock journalism. He went back and looked at this because this all became a phenomenon. The French absolutely adored and embraced all of these American pulp writers, including some that weren't as famous as Raymond Chandler. He went back and relooked at them. The Long Goodbye, they just took out about 90 pages of it because it was just kind of too long. It didn't fit in their formula. And some of these translations were just totally ham-handedly done, but also in a very stylistic type of way, uniform. They imposed a uniform style on these very disparate writers there. So there's like this great, and of course, French, you know, felt very culturally superior to America's narrow tastes here. And so, you know, we appreciate your genre writers more than you do. And it's like, actually, you totally mangled them, but you created your own new thing. It's kind of a wonderful and beautiful story. Catherine?
If I can just jump in real quick, Matt, on that point, one of the things that actually to bring The Long Goodbye or that period and that type of writing to bear on contemporary sensibilities, one of the things that's fascinating about Chandler is that his characters and his world is materially rich. It's people who have, you know, are indelibly scarred by living through the Depression and fighting World War II and now have kind of absolute freedom and feel completely at odds with the world or with no direction and nothing really to go on other than alcoholism or sybaritism or suicide. And it's an interesting kind of moment to go back after, you know, if in the contemporary moment we're lacking a common purpose. You know, this happened after World War II as well, and then it kind of got sucked into a 1950s dream of kind of consumerism and mass culture becoming widely available to people. But it's kind of interesting to look at the parallels of, you know, where you win a big war, and we've won a massive war against, you know, a kind of repression of individual differences. People are more free to live however they want ever before, and we're kind of sad about it.
Catherine, what are you sad about?
I'm only happy, as you know. Actually, my what I'm consuming is a great full circle from the beginning of the pod, because what I watched this weekend was Marie Kondo's reality show, Tidying Up.
Keep hearing about this. Must
which
be,
is a big thing that white ladies like. And so as a white lady, I was like, I need to watch this. Netflix was like, I'm pretty sure you want to watch this. And I was like, I do. Thank you, Netflix. and it's actually precisely about whether stuff tortures us or gives us joy and how to figure out which stuff is which. Because, of course, everybody actually does kind of have too much stuff. Right? Like Tucker is right about that. And this is also a Marie Kondo
wrong
insight. That you just have like a lot of junk in your house that like you probably don't actually need.
You just need more space.
Yeah, right. So one option is more space, but when that is not an option, and this is like a sensation that has been sweeping the country for a while. Her advice, very briefly, is you basically take all the stuff in each category, clothing, whatever, put it in a big pile, and then pull out the things from that pile that you actually legit like and use and throw away everything else. And as someone who loves to throw things away, I really, really enjoyed watching the 8 minutes of this show that I ended up watching, because the problem is it's still a reality show and reality shows are bad and annoying. So there's just like a lot of monologuing to the camera and a lot of feelings that are like, eh. And
wait, what are feelings like?
You heard me. And the, you know,
are all feelings, or just
certainly
these particular
performative
feelings?
Camera feelings about whether or not to get rid of your dead husband's Hawaiian shirt collection are,
Are you going to make your kids do like a kind of Sophie's Choice for their toys?
You know, we at our house, we do an occasional toy purge. And the deal is that any child can veto a specific toy out of the pile. But, you know, some stuff's got to go to make room for the new toys.
It's like the Purge?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know how the Purge works.
It's a series of movies about it. Society where they kill people.
I'm happy to hear
that
somebody's benefit. I'm happy to hear that Netflix's recommendations are working for somebody. One of the last things they recommended to me was Fern Gully 2, The Magical Rescue.
That's not wrong, FYI. Fern Gully is great.
I don't know. I mean, I'm barely through the Land Before Time series.
But anyway, I do just want to say, if you actually like reality shows at all, maybe this would be a good show for you, except it's like, it doesn't have the other element of reality shows, which I think people like, which is that the people on the shows, their lives are way more screwed up than yours. The people on this show, like, their lives are kind of normal and they just need to clean out their closet.
I will end this round with season 3 of A Series of Fortunate Events, which I watched with my 10-year-old daughter, Lemony Snicket series. By far the best season, the third and last season here. I've watched 5 of the 7 or 8 episodes. Neil Patrick Harris is the star and the executive producer, and a bunch of other interesting people. It's kind of campy. If you're not familiar with the story series, it's basically what it sounds like. Terribly torturous. All kinds of terrible things happen to these orphan kids as they go through, and Neil Patrick Harris is the villain. But I bring it up not just because it's enjoyable and I appreciate the well-executed nature of it, but unlike the Marie Kondo or whatever her name, Kandahar show, I haven't heard anyone ever mention this show in non-mixed company. I've not seen a single tweet about this. And I even follow them on Twitter. And I don't see any tweets about this here. It's amazing to me how much good, even a very good cultural product is out there that can't even penetrate through, even with Lemony Snicket series, which is a very popular children's book series out there. So it has a built-in thing. We had Nick and some friends over for dinner on Saturday, and or Friday or one of those days. And it as happens when you get people of our basic age together in a place, you end up talking about what TV shows that you're watching. I don't understand you people who have time to watch TV shows. Beyond that, it's interesting. Like, people are out there trying to there's so much stuff that they're sharing information on where to find stuff. It's almost like the way that we used to in the days before kind of the internet would look for music. You would get around your friends and like, hey, I went to this one record store that had this one like thing from the college rock list in the back of Rolling Stone. And you would kind of share intel that way. There's so much product out there and a lot of it very good that it's this word of mouth TV is it's kind of a wonderful world that we're living in. And it's certainly a lot more interesting than the goddamn Golden Globes broadcast, which I watched last night. And that's all the gratuitous cursing we have time for here. Thank you for listening, everyone, to the Reason Podcast Editors Roundtable Edition. We'll be back next week as well. And there's other Reason Podcast wonderfulness throughout the week. Goodbye.